good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for today's Thought Leader Roundtable. Today is part of a regular series of conversations on readiness. It's really an exploration of two key questions, the first of which is, what does it mean for all young people to be ready for life's demands at every stage? And the second is, what will it take to get there? Karen Pittman, CEO of the Forum for Youth Investment, leads lively and candid conversations with some of the most influential, boundary-pushing leaders working to improve the lives of children and young people in the USA. Today's topic is exploring the science behind preparing youth to thrive in the SEL Challenge. Karen Pittman will be joined by Charles Smith, Haviland Rummel, and Brett Hart for a conversation on the extensive process of interviews, site visits, evaluations, convenings, and surveys that form the foundation of the SEL Field Guide titled Preparing Youth to Thrive, Promising Practices in Social and Emotional Learning. Today's discussion will center around research findings and their applications for social-emotional learning and continuous program improvement. I wanted to start by telling you a little bit about each of our presenters today. First, Karen Pittman is President and CEO of the Forum for Youth Investment and a respected sociologist and leader in youth development. Prior to co-founding the Forum in 1998, she launched adolescent pregnancy prevention initiatives at the Children's Defense Fund, started the Center for Youth Development and Policy Research, and served as Senior Vice President at the International Youth Foundation. Charles Smith is Executive Director of the David P. Weikert Center for Youth Program Quality. Charles has guided the Weikert Center to a position of national prominence in the areas of quality assessment and performance accountability policies for out-of-school time programs. Charles led the development and validation of one of the field's most prominent performance improvement tools, the Youth Program Quality Assessment. Haviland Rummel is the Executive Director at SCE, where she leads the organization's strategy and grant-making in digital learning and social and emotional learning. SCE is invested in shaping an ecosystem of anytime, anywhere, 21st century learning to prepare youth to adapt and thrive in a rapidly changing and highly connected world. Brett Hart is the Executive Director of the Philadelphia Wooden Boat Factory, a strengths-based craft apprenticeship program for youth in the maritime arts and sciences. For Brett, the path that led to his work in positive youth development began as a teenager with his own apprenticeship in traditional wooden boat building and eventually his work as a tall ship master. A few logistical notes for today. There is no visual component of today's session. We will be accepting questions and comments via Twitter both during the sessions and all week. Please use the hashtag. I will spell this out. It's one word, SEL Challenge. That is SELCHALLENGE, to join the conversation. Today's session is being recorded. Later this week, it will be sent to everyone who registered and posted to the SELPractices.org and Forum for Youth Investment websites. So, Karen, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Thank you. It's great to get back on the phone with exciting people. Today, we really have the challenge of having three exciting people on the phone as opposed to one. So we are going to try to keep it lively. We're prepared if questions start to come in to stay on the call a little after 3, but we'll stop it promptly at 3 to let folks go who have to go. So do send your questions in as you have them to hashtag SEL Challenge. You don't have to wait to the end. If you have a question for a particular speaker, please go ahead and put it in whenever you have it. I'm going to start with Haviland because the Susan Crown Exchange funded this exciting study, and I know that I'm biased, but I don't think I'm alone in any way in my assessment that this research study really is an incredible gift to the field, and in particular to out-of-school time practitioners and evaluators. So, Haviland, can you just take a minute to explain how the foundation approached the decision to fund this study and why, in particular, you landed on this unique study design?
Sure. Thank you, Karen, and thanks to everyone on the call today. We're really excited about this work, and we're pleased that you can join us. So our foundation, SDE, focuses on how young people develop the skills they need to thrive in the 21st century, and we do this primarily through programs in digital learning and social and emotional learning. We started our SEL program area specifically about 3 years ago because we saw that these skills are as, if not more, important than traditional academic achievement, and are strongly correlated to life success. So this could mean healthy relationships, employability, academic achievement, health and well-being. And we really saw a gap or white space in the number of sustainable efforts focused on social and emotional learning for teens. But we saw that amazing work was happening in out-of-school time and specifically in after-school programs. and wanted to shine a light on these programs and specifically the practices and really dissect what was happening there so that other programs and other organizations can be more intentional in their approach to helping young people develop social and emotional skills. So essentially, the SEL Challenge, the study was designed to identify these promising practices and then support the replication of these practices at greater scale. And the way we did it was we held a national call for programs. We wanted to select a variety of programs. The study, from about 242 letters of inquiry, we selected the 8 organizations that you can learn more about in the technical report, also in the field guide on SELpractices.org. And we used both a qualitative and quantitative method for the study that included literature review, framework development, identification of domains, so empathy, emotion management, things like that, identification of practices or what we're calling standards, 3 convenings over the course of 2 years, site visits, interviews with both staff and youth and leaders at the organizations we work with, measurement, development, and data collection, performance studies, benchmarking, and then, of course, case studies or vignettes. And one of the most important components, I think, that drove our design was to elevate the expert practitioner and their voices, because we believe that the after-school environment really offers a goldmine for the types of work and practices that are going on in social and emotional learning. And we just really wanted to elevate what was happening there and share that with others. So the kind of ultimate piece of this work is that there's tools and technical assistance that are developed throughout the process to help other out-of-school time programs focus deeply on SEL practice and assess their own programs, practices, and strengths.
Well, it sounds complicated, and it was complicated, but I think it was also highly interactive. And so I just wonder, Brett, you went through this. What was it like to be a part of this, and did it feel like your typical sort of program evaluation or any other experience that you'd had before?
Yeah. Well, so first, the opportunity to come together with these other 7 agencies was really profound for our organization. And to do so, you know, kind of like in seclusion for days at a time, where we lived these conversations about SEL, not just during the day, but late into the evenings, was really powerful and meaningful to our organization. You know, as I'm going to allude to later, you know, this the process and the process of looking at the data, actually, that actual activity even influenced downstream how we even changed some aspects of our program and helped us grow. And I want to speak to that a little bit later. This was a phenomenal process to be a part of.
And Charles, obviously you were the mastermind behind this and figuring out how to really work with this set of expert practitioners to pull things together. I've heard you often say that this recent set of research really laid the groundwork for creating the last pieces of the puzzle that the field needs to really help practitioners fine-tune their practices and link them to observable improvements in youth outcomes, and in particular in these social-emotional outcomes. Why was this so important for us to get these last pieces, and what are they?
Yeah, yes, Karen, thanks, and it's a pleasure to talk with everyone today. So, you know, last pieces, important pieces, last pieces might be, asking a little too much, but at least I think the Weikert Center has a continuous improvement model we do with clients, and in very important ways, this work was designed to fit into a continuous improvement kind of paradigm or a way of looking at how to use your data and how to build a learning community around the purposes that an organization has. So, the important parts of, or some missing pieces, were to try to sort out how we talk about what individual SEL skills are. That can be a very confusing conversation, And then to extend that discussion of what are the skills, what are the behaviors, what's going on inside the person, inside that, what are their mental contents and processes, and then to link that to the environment or the setting where the kids spend time, the instructional environment. And so I think that while almost none of the practices that we enumerate in the standards are new practices, people both from the learning sciences and from prior work on SEL and even social work best practice, I think you'll see a lot of well-established ideas about how to interact with youth to advance child development. The theoretical work that we really tried to add was, again, the focus on the individual and separating out the things that are going on inside a kid's head from the behaviors that they're enacting, and then separating both of those things, again, from the qualities of the environment. Because it is humans learn from environment and from their interaction with environment. And so if we want to build environments that optimize learning, even if it is learning about SEL skills, we have to be intentional about how those environments are designed. And, you know, if we're delivering instruction to kids who the group of kids change every year, the circumstances change, the community resources and circumstances change, you have to continuously think, experts have to continuously think and readjust and figure out how to respond to kids who have these needs. And so, we tried to break those parts, those pieces apart, the environment, the mental process, and the behavior, so that we could look at them separately and really engage the experts. And this is where this methodology, it sounds very complicated, it's just a mixed methods design. We spent a lot of time talking to the expert practitioners who had various models they used to build SEL skills with kids, and then we did some performance studies. We measured, we did quantitative measurement at these sites. But it was really the wisdom and expertise of the practitioners, of the folks like Brett who were a part of the study, that gave coherence to all that data. They were able to tell us about their curriculum and about the sequence of experiences they wanted the kids to have so that they could build SEL skills. So it was very much a bottom-up process, drawing on expert practitioners and folks who had been doing this work for a very long time, and then trying to help with separating out the parts so we could identify environment as this and behavior as this different thing, and then ask some questions about the mental processes of the kids that are so important that happen in between the environment and the behavior.
So let's get concrete for a minute, and Brett, I'll have you jump in as well. So let's just talk for a minute about how many times measurement happened, and what it was. So we talked about measuring behavior. We talked about measuring the environment. These are observational measures, and how frequently were they done over the course of what time period?
Yeah, so if you wanted me to jump in. So at the Wooden Boat Factory, and just to make sure that the context is there for everyone, so Wooden Boat Factory is a craft apprenticeship program. So we're building traditional wooden boats with students in an out-of-school time setting. And there were a number of different kind of aspects to the evaluative process, including things, items like the PQA, which Charles developed, which was really – that had a profound impact on our program, and obviously we're continuing – we continue to use all the measures moving forward in our program beyond the study. But so, for example, the PQA was a process where our staff were able to train to become expert, quote-unquote, evaluators of process. So, for example, for me personally, it was the first opportunity for me to take a tool into my shop and sit down and observe our staff in action. And I got to say, very often when our staff are, if I were to walk onto the shop floor while somebody is, working with a young person in our program, I'm going to get involved and, I'm going to be a part of what's going on. And the PQA kind of, arrested that and allowed me to be an observer and to, it was interesting to see what aspects of our program, how I would articulate them, kind of in a public setting, what of those aspects were actually really occurring. And conversely, also then to then use the PQA as this tool that says, okay, then I can give feedback to our staff because we there are a lot of best practices, right? And you, as a staff member, as a direct service provider, you you know, you might lose sight of certain aspects of the work for just a moment, and so the PQA gave us the opportunity to examine those and say, hey, you know, look, these interactions, remember that these are our best practices, and these are the things. And then the staff person says, oh yeah, absolutely, of course, no, and thank you for reminding me. So the PQA was really valuable. We did that at 3 points throughout the year. We did the beliefs and behavioral scales, which were really fantastic. You know, so we have used biometric, and I'll use that word, surveys in the past, but what was really profound about the beliefs versus behavioral scale was it was the first opportunity to give the student an opportunity to assess their own, feelings about where they were. But then also with the behavioral scale, which is a staff observation, for the staff to observe and say, oh, you know what? And then we can take this data and we can look at it and say, okay, so a student is saying this about their own personal belief, and they're showing us this. And is there a disparity between the two? And if there is a disparity from a kind of improved data point from internally to our staff, that's something that we can sit down and we can look at it and we can say, okay, you know what? This student is telling us this and we're seeing this, so what does that mean to us? And again, those were done 3 times throughout the year.
Sorry, I was going to piggyback on Brett. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I think what was important also in the design of this process is that the collecting the data was such a big piece, but what to do with that data was something we really wanted to focus on, especially in the spirit of continuous improvement. So we built in time through both in-person convenings and also webinars and calls in between these in-person convenings to understand how to plan with that data, how to educate your staff about what that data means and how to improve your programs. So our entire second convening was actually called Planning with Data, and we had a variety of sessions about how to take that data and then use it to improve programs and outcomes.
Yeah, that's perfect. And that was a wonderful description. Charles, do you want to add anything in about the instruments from the technical side?
Well, I would just say that, we back to that kind of environment, mental, behavioral, scheme, we tried to have measures of each of those things. And especially on the theory side, we were trying to get to the point where we could kind of help people separate out attention and emotion as very important processes in learning SEL skills, in the sense that emotion can move really fast. It can be almost instantaneous in the effects that it has on the body and affect and feelings. And it really channels attention, right? Emotion really drives attention or helps focus attention. And so if we're going to focus on social and emotional learning, we have to be able to think about what is it about the context that helps kids focus and keep staying in an emotional state that allows them to stay focused, that makes that focusing their highest priority. And so we saw, in the pattern of results in these settings, extremely high engagement on the part of the kids. We asked the kids about their level of engagement with the content on 3 different days over the course of the offering, and most of these offerings were 8 to 9 months long. So we asked them at different points how engaged, and at almost every time point, almost every kid, there were 150-some youth in the 8 programs, said that they were either engaged or very engaged. I forget exactly what the wording of the scale was, but they were on the highest point of the scale. So these were programs, offerings that were delivering highly engaging content to the kids. The learning communities that we came together, that Haviland was just talking about, were so interesting because all of these programs were very successful at delivering this content and focusing on SEL skills, but they talked about it in different ways. And so as folks who might be listening might think about bringing groups of organizations together to talk about social emotional learning, that's really a great thing to do, because one of the biggest barriers, even in this group of career-long experts on the matter, one of the biggest barriers is getting to the same language so that we can talk to each other. Just so we know that the things that many people have been instinctively doing for throughout their professional careers are in fact these very important practices for building social emotional skills.
Yeah, I think the idea of bringing folks together in learning communities, I mean, there's a replicability to the design that you put together that I think goes beyond, how you put this together to really come up with the measures and validate things. And I think it's something to share with folks, the combination. I mean, rarely have I had people be so excited about describing what they did to actually, you know, sort of jump in and do measures and use data. Havlin, a question for you, and then Brett, you also. Did it feel risky to be asking providers to jump into a space in which they were going to work together to define these SEL skills, measure their quality, and then also test out whether the skills were growing without knowing? They assumed that was happening, but they didn't necessarily know that. Did that feel like a risk that you were taking on the funder side? And Brett, from the provider side, did that sound like a risk, even though you really are pretty confident that your program is doing things?
That's a really good question, Karen. And, you know, part of the beauty of this foundation is that we all are allowed to and willing to take risks, really, to push some boundaries and find new solutions. So it's kind of in the nature of our approach to philanthropy here. But, you know, I think we knew that there would be times that were undefined or that would be messy. But, you know, having read the just the narratives that these programs provided through proposals and through conversations, we knew that there was, a lot of magic there, not to be cliche, but a lot of beautiful things happening, and they're doing great jobs, and that we just wanted to make sure we were able to capture that right. So there was some risk, but we weren't concerned that, any of these programs or organizations, partners that we work with, weren't able to explain what they did or how their kids kind of go through this process of learning in their organization. So, we took a little bit of risk with the structure and bringing, a diverse group of people together. But I think a lot of this kind of interdisciplinary work will help, kind of push this field forward. And I think we should be creating more incentives, and opportunities for this type of work to happen.
Great. I mean, Brett, did it feel like a risk to you to step in with a funder to be able to test out whether you were actually making the differences you thought you were making?
Well, I mean, I would say not at all. I mean, not sure. Risk because we were going to learn, right? So we were going to learn about our program, and risk suggests that there was going to be an outcome that we wouldn't be happy about, and in fact, I can't imagine what that would have been. I mean, this was an opportunity for us to, in fact, I think to an extent, some of the evaluative tools were what were being tested as much so as the outcomes of the program, and I was really happy with these tools after we had used them. These tools really helped us further develop our work in our program.
Good. Let me remind folks that the hashtag is SEL Challenge. That's SEL Challenge. I know we've been talking a lot about data and things, but if you've got questions, please chime in. Brett, get concrete with us for a bit. I know that when we talked last week, you explained that having had this opportunity to really sort of dig deep and look at practice, you actually made some changes over the past year. Can you talk a little bit in very concrete ways about some of the places that you've actually made changes and how you do your programming or how you train staff or do practices based on the feedback that you got?
Sure, yeah. When we talk about our apprenticeship, and I want to stress, too, that apprenticeship to us, we're not framing this in a Department of Labor context, right? So our program is not about training apprentices to be ready to enter the workforce, be it in boat building or home construction or what have you. I mean, we've always understood our work as about, you know, whether we had framed it as social and emotional learning or individual agency, which is, we kind of feel, is the arc of our program. That's always what it was really about. You know, there's a great group here in Philadelphia that runs with young people, and they're called Students Run Philly Style, and they have this great tagline that says, "Did you really think that this was about the running?" And so from our perspective, you know, we had, going into the SEL challenge, we had, the way I would describe it is I would say that the SEL content was embedded in our work. So, and I'm going to speak at a 50,000 foot level, and if you want to come down a little later in the conversation, be happy to do so. But what I mean by that is that essentially, you know, the SEL content was embedded in our approach that is very much founded in motivational interviewing, for example. It's how we interact with the young people. You know, it also includes some mindfulness and meditation that we begin our days with, and a lot of praxis opportunities, so action and reflection, et cetera. And then as we entered into this challenge, we started to examine these SEL content areas as we identified as the group, the domains that were important to us. These items became even more and more clear to us. So over time, and here we are, you know, a year after the close of the data, and that process, we are now an organization that went from having an embedded into our work type of SEL intervention to one where our MSWs, and we have two social workers on our staff, are leading actually deliberate and what's the word I'm trying to use here is they're actually delivering SEL content to the students in a formal setting. So, for example, having a process, you know, one day a week the boat builders meet and do an activity that is SEL related. And, you know, I'll finish by saying we elicit a lot of feedback from our students, right? So we're continually looking to hear from them what's important. And I think, you know, what's been interesting since we actually began to implement activities in SEL, like activities like In Plain Sight, which I'm not going to dive into fully here, but when we elicit that information from our students is what strikes them. You know, these are young people who are, you know, high school students, incredibly social by nature. And this, you know, these activities are actually giving them a chance to be kids in a safe environment while also feeling they're making a contribution to the craft work as well. So they absolutely have affirmed this kind of changeover to bringing in more intentional SEL activities into the fabric of a craft apprenticeship, and it's been really meaningful for us.
Great. Charles, we've got a question, and I'll let you walk through it. Where can people find more information about the scales themselves, about the studies? I know that this project has generated a multitude of pieces. Can you describe what's out there and where they are?
Sure. So we have, in terms of the kind of the most, there are a suite of measures that we used in this study. They are, that suite of measures is described in the technical report that will, you know, be available online very shortly. The research summary for that report is available online. The measures themselves as code books are also available at the SEL website and at the Weikert Center website. We'll be continue rolling these products out as we go along. I think that so the technical report itself, chapter 3 and 2 appendices are directly about the measures and our efforts to start determining the reliability and validity of the data that they produce. We are at an early phase in that process. We have recruited some folks to work with us and collect kind of new samples in this program year, and, you know, we'll continue to work on these measures as we go through time. Those measures include a set of observational rubrics that are the for those of you who know our work, are the PQA-type measure for SEL practices, a staff rating of youth behavior, so a behavioral measure of SEL skills that's completed by the staff, and then a set of youth report measures. You know, these measures are like other measures in the field. So, you know, there are many options. We at Weikert are happy to talk with you about the best options to fit measures to your purposes. But if you're making those decisions, the technical report is designed to help with that that those decisions. We talk about feasibility of implementation. We talk about the usefulness of the data, and then we do the kind of more traditional reliability and validity analyses. So the technical report is really the place to look.
Good. Karen, can I add something to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's also a kind of a free tool or suite of tools that came out of this online at SDLpractice.org called the SDL Strengths Builder method, and
yeah.
That is three different assessment tools that are assessing your curriculum design, assessing your practices, and assessing your youth SEL skills. So those, the packet of all of those three assessment tools are a great way to kind of start this work with your staff and with your organization. Those are all available online as well.
And those are available at SELpractices.org.
Right. And it's called the SEL Strengths Builder.
Right. And they're terrific.
And Karen, I just would make one addition to that. So the common thing across the measurement tools, and in this study, we weren't trying to design or develop a one best measurement, one best measure, right, for all situations. We were really trying to use a breadth of measures that fit a number of different kinds of situations and uses for data. One of the common things across all the measures, the Strength Builder measures that that Haviland mentions on the website, and the versions of those measures, which are also included in the technical report that are related, is the granularity of data that they produce, both the observation of staff practices, the staff observation of youth practices or skills, the demonstration of skills, those and the curriculum assessment, all of those tools are designed to help us collect information at a pretty granular level of data. So granular, what I mean by that, it's not granola. What it means is that, you know, people learn from modeling, right? People learn from seeing someone else do or from a mental model of how to carry out any particular act or skill. And so when we count something, when we measure something, a youth behavior or a staff behavior in a setting, we want that description of the thing that we counted to be granular. We want it to be a description of a behavior or an action that can be a model. That somebody can say, oh, I can do that, or I don't do enough of that, or even more importantly, is there a reason why when I see two kids do the same thing, I give them a different score? So even examining our own assumptions about how we see kids. And so across all of these, this kind of proximal set of measures, our intent was to get to a granular level where the item level information was a kind of a model for something that these experts told us was important to do. So that's a commonality across the measures. They can be used, not all the same measures are for the same purpose.
All right, so I'm going to do two things as we're sort of hitting the midpoint. One is to tell folks there is a lot of technical stuff behind this report. That's why there's a separate technical report. And Charles has offered for those who are on the phone, who are in charge of evaluation or research at their organizations or interested in this, he's offered to actually do a separate webinar really walking through some of the key pieces of the technical report. So if there are more technical questions that are coming in and you want to hear that, we will set that up separately. A couple of quick questions as more questions are coming in. One is, can we measure SEL growth over shorter terms? If your program is, over 12 weeks, is that enough time to demonstrate growth? Is there a magic number?
So I think that this was an issue that we were especially concerned with in this study, because much of the work on social emotional learning, in particular description of growth of SEL skills, now that can be called a lot of different things in the research literature, but the growth of those skills, they tend to be longitudinal studies that go over multiple years rather than just multiple months or weeks. And so many of the measures are designed to be sensitive, that is to detect the change that actually happens over very long periods. And so how do you get a measure that's sensitive to interventions that occur over short periods and that is focused on the thing that actually changes? So that was one of the issues we really tried to address in the study, both to test some youth report measures that are like other youth report kinds of measures about skills. I believe I can, right? The youth is saying I can do this, to test to see if those measures, in fact, would go up over a 9-month intervention. And then to develop the behavioral measures, the staff ratings of youth behavior that are about what the youth is doing in this setting in the last couple of weeks. Again, just trying to maximize the sensitivity of the measure. And what we found was we had statistically significant change over 3 time points for almost all of the measures, youth belief and staff report of youth behavior. And almost all the measures that change over the 3 time points was statistically significant. So, the measures in the challenge, in this first round of use seem to be pretty well calibrated to these interventions, which were all, they were like school year length interventions. Much shorter interventions, you want to look at the items and see if the skill is something that the kid comes in without and leaves with. So it really is about looking at the measure and the purposes.
Good. So I think another way to say that, your last sentence, is whatever the length and intensity of your program, if you really do think you're doing something specifically enough to get a change in beliefs and behaviors, then it's worth using this kind of a survey and observation instrument. So it's less about a magic number of how much time, how many weeks, but I think one of the things, Charles, that you said, and I'd love to get Brett back in and Havlin as well, is that in some ways it was risky to even think that doing, 3 measures over the course of a year was actually going to be enough time to show change. And, in fact, you did show change on both the results and the beliefs in that. And what was what's the scale? So someone has asked, how are you quantifying those? What are people going to see when they get their results back?
Well, for these measures, we create composite scores. So we have 6 domains: emotion management, empathy, teamwork, initiative, responsibility, and problem solving. So we have gathered multiple scales or multiple measures in each of those domains. And that means you can kind of, the way we work with our clients and the way we would recommend that people use these measures is you kind of pick and choose in the skill domains that are the focus of your work. So if your work is really focused on, you've got kids who are already doing things that they know how to do over long periods of time, maybe responsibility is the domain of interest. And so, we would suggest that you select, you don't have to implement all the measures at all times. So there's some it's important to select in that sense.
Okay, all right. Let me come back to you for a minute. Oh, Brett, jump in, please.
I mean, I just had a quick thought, but this theme came to me numerous times over the course of the last couple of years, which is the domains are completely intertwined. I mean, so yes, you can pick certain domains, but at the same time, the skills that are developing in any one share commonalities with other domains, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that was true in the pattern of empirical findings, too. That's right.
Good. All right. So we hope we're getting people excited, interested to go look at the Preparing Youth Thrive, the practitioner guide, as well as the methodology and findings as they come out. Havlin, you all made several decisions as you pulled this group of providers together. The first decision was to really focus on adolescents. The second decision, I think, was really to sort of pull together programs that really were working with, if not exclusively, predominantly low-income young people. Young people of color are all sort of overrepresented in the young people who are participating in these programs.
Mm-hmm.
Why those decisions? And is this applicable to all youth? Is this applicable to younger youth? Is it applicable to learning environments that are in different settings? Schools, employment programs. Where do we go with this learning?
Sure. So we approach this work and really our entire SEL portfolio with an equity lens, like kind of looking at what disparities exist among different populations. So our overall goal really is to help create access to higher quality programs and learning environments for all youth. But what we found in our research, and this won't be, you know, rocket science, is that all access to these settings that build SEL skills are not necessarily equally available to all youth, and that this lack of access can constitute a developmental risk factor. So youth that experience higher levels of poverty or instability in our communities, violence, really, you know, have more exposure to stress and trauma. This can kind of produce negative effects over the course of their lives. So we wanted to help design and strengthen programs for who those opportunities may be least available. So that was our focus there. But we also wanted to choose a variety of program contexts so that you can see how these practices look in different organizations and that you could identify yourself or your program in this work, whether you're a community service group, outdoor education, arts. We wanted to show really that these practices could be used across different contexts. And then also with the focusing on teens, when we did research to launch this program, we saw a lot of programs happening with younger age groups, and a lot going on in school. But we didn't see as much, as many programs, effective programs happening at the high school age. As we study kind of further about, about development, we learned that this is still one of the most pivotal stages of development, your teenage years, and that your brain is still developing so rapidly so that these skills would still, have outcomes for that age group. So we did focus on that group for that reason, but I think a lot of these practices, and you'll see from vignettes from the programs, they can be used at middle school level. I think they can be adapted for other ages as well, and you know some of these practices specifically can be used in other environments, like in school, and that's really why we focus specifically on practices and not programs. In that we wanted to find something that you could use across different environments and across different program types.
Yes, and that's been extremely powerful, and I think it's extremely important, and I want to repeat that sentence again because I just have been in 2 days of meetings where getting people to understand that we really can identify these practices that can be taken into taken into different environments, taken into structured learning spaces where young people are learning quite different types of content in different ways. It's hard to get people out of the program language, so it's a really important piece to have. And Heavlin, I think your point that all of the information at this point that we have is really pointing to the enormous value of creating these kind of high quality learning environments for young people who don't have them otherwise, who don't have them perhaps in the community or in their schools. Is pretty important. At the end of the day, the study identified several things that turn out to be sort of the common denominators across these exemplary programs. The fact that you've got diverse staff and youth, intensive participation in the program, and really expert levels of adult guidance, and that word guidance, that they're not just coming in to sort of learn content, they're really being actively guided. Highly collaborative organizational structures, exceptional high-quality instruction, and, as you mentioned, Charles, youth engagement. It's rare to go into a setting and get 100% of young people actually engaged, sometimes just attending, but you're not even talking about attendance. You're talking about active engagement. And then that you demonstrate, and we're able to demonstrate this pattern of positive skill growth across risk statuses. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. That the young people who came into the program, perhaps with some of the weakest skills, benefited equally or greater than those who came in with higher skills. So you've got a lot going on in these programs. One of the challenges of replicating is perhaps the staff to youth ratio. So Brett, as you think about, you clearly meet all these criteria. What does it take to pull this off? What's your staff-to-youth ratio? How much do you invest in sort of training and professional development for your staff? What does it take to keep this quality of an environment alive?
Yeah. Well, to answer that last part of the question first, I mean, our investment in staff is pretty significant. I mean, we spend a half a day every week, Fridays, in professional development that's led by our social work team. And then they're also bringing in outside agencies to help bring research and foreign practices into our program. And so that's very important to us, as is the culture of our organization. Many of you are probably familiar with the Sandra Bloom model, the trauma-informed model that very much speaks to how staff, the health of your staff, and how that impacts the downstream effect that it has in program on a day-to-day level. So we have a very, very healthy environment here, I believe, very low staff turnover, which is really important to, you know, that continuity really, really contributes to the success of the program. But to answer the first part of your question, you know, we are, if you include our volunteers, we're currently at kind of a 1-to-4 mentor or staff person to student ratio, which is phenomenal. And it's expensive. I mean, we're investing about $8,000 per student, and a student is with us 470 hours a year. So it's a tremendous commitment on their end. And we're making a tremendous commitment back to them. Our staff to student ratio is very low. And, you know, I frame that often in terms of, you know, if you look at the city of Philadelphia and the investment that they make in public school students, so it's about $12,000 per pupil. You know, state average is about 15, and then Lower Merion, which is a very affluent neighborhood, they're at about 22. And so when you combine, and we are very intentional to make sure we're partnering well with the school, so that they're not two disparate efforts. If the school is investing, you know, say $12,000 in a student, and we're investing $8,000, that we're making sure that those two investments are not a 12 and 8 by themselves, but they are that they match to a 20, so that we're giving that student the same advantages, hopefully as many as we can, as the young person from the main line. But there are other agencies, and you know, our intervention is very deep. You know, 2 social workers on our staff, 80 apprentices. 10 staff total. And there are other agencies here who are doing fantastic work in the city, who have found clever ways to also do very similar work with much lower, lower staff to student ratios. So yes, we are doing it very intensively with a high ratio, but both are possible.
Charles or Howland, is Brett at the low end with a 1-to-4, or do you know what the range was in the 8 program?
That was the low end. In the 8, the top end though, I think was 1-to-10 or 1-to-8. So there were no 1-to-20, circumstances in this study.
Okay.
And Karen, can
questions?
I just make an observation here? So in the learning community, from each of the 8 organizations, we invited 3 staff members, 3 team members from each group. So, frontline staff and a leader and an evaluation team member. And in 2 years, we had 1 or 2 total out of about, 24 people turnover. So it was really, I think, unique from this group that the staff turnover was extremely low, even in this cohort for the, for the learning community, it was very low. So I think that also in what we heard from the organizations was that really investing in your staff was extremely important for the success of the program.
Okay.
Karen, could I add one more point there?
Yes.
So we did, part of the study was this qualitative part, and we produced, 30-some standards, 70-some practice indicators that are the detail on the standards, and then over 300 vignettes. So we tried to get three or four vignettes. That is a quotation from one of our experts during the interview and on-site focus group process, but a quotation about their program, that just three or four of those for each practice indicator. Because one of the problems is translation. So just understanding this practice in my context, in my clinical or disciplinary language, is a tough thing to do. So we wanted to name the standards and practice indicators. Again, very little new information there, and then put multiple vignettes by each one to illustrate. In that sense, you can pick any one of the practices. They're all good practices. They look a lot like other practices. You know, they're not new, and they look a lot like the practices in the learning sciences. You can pick any one or any group of these to work on, and that's a great thing to work on. However, different from an individual practice or a few practices was there was a curriculum model going on here. So when we're talking about the low staff-to-student ratios, the other thing that's happening is in these eight programs, not only are they doing the individual practices, but they're putting them all together in a pretty intensive curriculum design that we called project-based learning with co-regulation, right? We're not trying to put a brand name on this. It's a very old idea, but we're trying to put, you know, the key parts. It's like project-based learning, but with staff who are really good at stepping in the moment and providing responses. So the kids are learning how to do something complicated. They're doing a community organizing, an advocacy campaign in the Boston Public Schools, or they're building a boat. These are complicated, multi-step, skill-building projects that cause challenges. They're hard to do. You got to learn a lot. And in those moments of challenge are particularly the moments where SEL skills get modeled and named, and where becoming more intentional about your SEL skills, that's those moments where that happens. And all eight of these programs were doing something very intensive in that sense, that they were taking kids through an intensive project-based learning design or a curriculum, and at the moments of challenge, they also had an SEL curriculum to step in and help model the response to a difficult circumstance. So, the low staff ratios are what it takes to do this very intensive thing. Any of the practices are a good thing to do, and we think have applicability by themselves or in groups or whatever in many other settings that probably don't have the same very low staff-to-student ratios.
Good, good. Well, we've got about a little less than 10 minutes left before we get to the official 3 o'clock end. I've got a bunch of questions coming in, but I think all coming in from the same very excited person, or at least the organization. So I'm going to ask one of those and then keep us moving with the commitment that we can stay on the phone for a couple minutes after the official 3 o'clock end and see if we can get more of those questions answered. So let me ask one of them, which is, I think comes up a lot. Did you do any training with the young people to make sure that they were being honest or accurate in their self-reporting? So you can give a quick answer to that, and then I'm going to ask you, Charles, if you can quickly just to compare over the three measurement times what you've got from a self-report in terms of growth versus what you've got from the observations.
Sure. So the first question was, I was focused on the second one. The first question.
Did we do anything to make sure young people were being honest or accurate in their self-reporting? And Brett, you can feel free to answer that question as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one of the important things about this study was we drew on an evidence base. So as soon as the RFP came out from the Susan Crown Foundation, I called Reed Larson, who has been doing this work for 20 years, based on interviewing youth. So hundreds, if not thousands, of interviews with adolescents on a set of skill categories that look a lot like the SEL skills that we were interested in. So we thought that drawing upon that evidence base, we could really minimize the amount of information that we tried to gather from the youth and really intensively focus on the work with the adults, the expert practitioners, because we ultimately really wanted to describe practices. So, we did focus groups with youth. We picked a couple of expert youth, that is kids who had gone through the offering in the prior year and had opinions about what that had done for them in their lives. And we did interview and do focus groups with those kids at their sites, but by far the predominance of the data, the qualitative data, was in an extensive set of applications and interviews, focus groups, and on-site observations of the staff. So the qualitative side and the development of the standards are driven by, initially Reed Larson's evidence base, working with interviewing youth over many years, many different articles in these respective domains, but then our intensive work with the staff. There isn't a ton of original youth data in this study in terms of the qualitative side and the development of the standards.
Great. All right, so I am going to, we're sort of at our 5-minute mark. If anybody else has a question that they want to sneak in, we will stay on the line a little extra to get to it. That's hashtag SEL challenge. So let me pull back. This really is exceptionally important, not just important research, but just an important really contribution to the field to be able to give practitioners this kind of feasible way to not only sort of have a common language and common standards, but ways to actually assess whether they're actually meeting those standards and then be able to sit down and think about improving, how to improve them. And that idea of a learning community or a small learning group to do that certainly makes sense and makes it much more meaningful. This isn't just about data collection, but really about data use and improvement. I am certainly convinced, as I expect many of the people on the call are, that this level of quality really is what's needed to help young people who both need to build these skills but also really have a paucity of this kind of quality learning environment in their lives, that this is a critical piece that has huge payoffs in terms of academic success, employment success, reductions in youth problems, et cetera, as well as just building young people's sense of confidence and agency. So I don't think there's any doubt, at least there's no doubt in my mind, that this is worth the investment. But I'd love each of you to think about and sort of talk about what next. Where do we go with this to scale it up, whether that means we jump into other systems or we make sure all youth programs are doing this. What is it that we have to do to really get this kind of quality learning environment made available to more young people who need it? Havlin, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So, one of the main reasons that we partnered with the Weikart Center on this project was that their belief in embedding SEL as an integral component of program quality, that was something that really aligned with our belief and that we want to focus on. It's not an add-on or, something else you do. It's part of the definition of quality. So I think that's an important piece. I think there's a lot of movement, obviously, around SEL, a lot of excitement. There's a lot from the funder side happening, and I think everyone kind of has their own role to play in redefining the narrative of what it takes to succeed now. And I think the best way to kind of approach it is think about, instead of kind of jumping in and feeling overwhelmed with how to embed SEL or how to take an SEL approach, is to really think about, what your organization does to help young people develop these skills and start there first and focus on, how to really hone in on that and strengthen that and kind of look holistically at your environment and your program.
Great. Brett?
Yeah, it's a big question. And I'll say that, the field of OST is a little bit of a double-edged sword in that I think a lot of people come to this work. Obviously, we have clinical staff, I refer to our MSWs, who bring a very much research-informed lens to our program. But I think a lot of people come to this work with their instincts. And in my case, those instincts were based on, my experience as an apprentice boat builder, as a sailor, et cetera. And then I think also we learn that through time and trial and error that our instincts often fail us, right? So, and it's bringing in, so two things here. First, bringing in that research-informed lens into a program is really critical. And then the second piece, which I had alluded to just prior to the call, which was that the field of OST has an opportunity to evolve at a really high pace right? We can experiment. We can try things like we've done in this SEL challenge. And then we can share that information, what we've learned with others. So we can iterate very quickly and learn a lot from the things that we're doing. And so I hope that that this information can get, you know, broadcast to many others as it was brought to us as well.
Great. And last official sentence in here, Charles, and then we'll turn to some more questions from the folks, which are now pouring in.
Sure. Yeah, for us, a couple of things are next. Continuing to work on the measures is, you know, this is a long-term project, so we just continue to work on that. We're trying to extend the standards down to the elementary level, so working with some elementary SEL experts to try to take what we've done with adolescents and apply it in for younger kids. And then the main thing next for us is we're just looking for partners. We learn about this work by iterating in the field with partners in real time. And so, you know, we're scouting around, looking for people to work with, administering the measures and using the data to continue the both the validation process, but also surfacing the expertise that's out there. One of the main byproducts of our work on quality over the last decade was we got to meet a whole bunch of people who were really good at it and who could really explain what it was. And so we want to meet those folks in the SEL work.
Okay. We've gotten to the official 3:00 time. So for those of you who have to leave us to go off to other appointments, I want to thank you for joining us. And
I just want to make a few comments. First of all, many thanks to Karen, Charles, Haviland, and Brett for a very thoughtful and helpful conversation. I wanted to remind you that today's session is being recorded. We'll stay on the line for a few more minutes to answer the final calls, and you'll be getting the recording early next week. And lastly, the full technical report will be emailed as follow-up at the end of the month.
Great. So, official part over, but if you're staying with us, there are more questions that have come in, and I think they actually pick up on several things that were just said. One of the things that Brett, both you and Charles mentioned was just really what it takes to make sure people are ready to do this work. We have a question of from one person asking, what degrees do you recommend? And I'm going to say, you know, if you recommend for undergraduates or graduates to pursue to be able to actually be prepared to do this kind of work with young people. Is this something that you get a degree in, or is this something that you find an exemplar youth organization and start to practice?
Sure. I mean, I'll take the first stab at that answer. Somebody reminded me the other day to always hire people that are smarter than yourself, and I think I've done a really great job at that. So I'll speak first to our social work staff. They have a profound ability to understand how we can lever this work beyond what we even realized was possible. And so having those, I feel like we've always done really great work here, but it's in the last, say, 3 years since we started bringing on MSWs onto our staff that we accelerated the pace at which we were able to do the work that we're doing. So certainly, you know, from a degree standpoint, that can't hurt. You know, our the degrees that we have on our staff, we have some people with degrees in sociology. I don't know that we have anybody with a degree in education. I will say that here's my byline when hiring, because we're teaching a very specific craft, be it marine science, be it traditional wooden boat building, be it sail making, be it sailing. And so what I've always said is that, you know, if you have to make a choice between hiring a traditional wooden boat builder or an educator, assuming that they don't have both of those skills, we always lean towards the educator, because I'd much rather, you're going to make mistakes, and I'd much rather have you making a mistake on the boat than with the student. So that's the approach that we look at this from. Charles, do you have something to add to that? Was there a question there?
So I was just saying, we're going to quote you on that, Brett. You've never had to make a mistake on the boat than the student. You're now an official. Go ahead, Charles.
Well, I was just going to say, in this project in particular, there were a lot of social workers, and the, you know, kind of the interpersonal practice in counseling focus areas in a social work degree seem a lot like the skill set that we're talking about in the standards. Now, again, many people implement practices like these standards and understand them, but if we're talking about where you can get the expertise if you haven't been working on it for a long time or don't just have it intuitively, this, as much as anything I've seen in the positive youth development field, seems like the skill set of folks who are in social work working with adolescents.
Good. Another question, and this is both can be a question to Charles, to Brett first, then Charles, and then Haviland. You can chime in to say what you actually have to think that this is important. So the question is, are there plans to do any follow-up to see if the skills are maintained after the kids leave the program? Certainly, Brett, you've talked about the fact that you're continuing to use the measures. So this wasn't just an evaluation for you. These measures are now a part of your practice. Do you do any follow-up after your young people leave the program?
Not yet, and that's actually a real hot topic that we're addressing on a half-day meeting tomorrow. So the answer is, you know, organizations that I'm aware of may employ a post-secondary social worker or some kind of support post-graduation. And I think that would be a real value add to our organization. Certainly in terms of continuing with the data, the evaluation, we're continuing to use the belief in behavioral scales. We're training our staff again this year in PQAs. So, I mean, this information was not just a one point in our history type of activity. This is something that we absolutely want to keep on board. And just briefly too, because going back to the question earlier about these biometric surveys, if that's what you want to call them, I don't know if Charles agrees with that term or not, but I have seen some in the past where, you know, somebody asked about gaming them. Do the students game these surveys, right? And I've seen surveys in the past where students, you know, I've had a student who said, hey, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, I'm off 5 in terms of my confidence. And then later on the survey, they said, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, do you want to improve your confidence? And they say 5. So it's like, well, wait a minute. You just told me there was nowhere left to go. This particular set, the beliefs and behavioral scales I'm referring to here mostly, were light years beyond that. And Charles referenced, I'm sorry, his name just went out of my head, Reed. Thank you. Reed Larson. I mean, I think that they just did a really nice job putting this together, and it's much more sophisticated and not so simplistic in its ways. I think I tried to answer two questions there at once.
You did, and you did a good job. Obviously, sort of doing this work is useful to get these measures and definitions into programs. Haviland, are you thinking that there's a value in actually doing follow-up in any way?
Yes, and we did not build that into the design of this project, unfortunately. It was kind of beyond our scope. But I do think that there's a need to do more of this kind of more longitudinal research and understanding about skill transfer and, you know, tracking these kids as they kind of go off into their lives. I would love to, now that I'm so close to these programs, kind of see how that happens. And I know each program kind of has different ways of doing that. So I do hope that some of the programs are able to capture that. But, you know, looking forward, or one thing I would change for the future is developing that into these, you know, if it's possible, to particular learning communities or programs, funding opportunities like this, but also hoping that others will be able to take more of a longitudinal look at this.
Okay. And one of the last questions, and I'm going to take the liberty of generalizing it a little bit, is we know certainly from the data that after school and youth programs are often staffed by part-time staff, staffed by volunteers and college students who don't necessarily have who intend to have a long time period with the organization. How does that play into really making sure that you have a total team that understands SEL practice? How do we account for what the workforce looks like?
Well, I think that our response to that in terms of the discussion section and recommendations in the full technical report is just to suggest that, hey, finding the people who are already good at this is a really important thing to keep thinking about, because while training people to think about social and emotional development and it is super important, and you know we all need these skills, so people tend to be very interested in it, and that's a really great thing to do. Also, trying to use the measures to identify people who are already good at it and who already know how to do this work and who already have been thinking about the kids and the community resources and how to help kids practice, you know, self-regulating or problem solving or however you want to frame it, the SEL skills, using the measures to identify the people in your community who are already good at it or the people who are, you know, coming into your organization who are already good at it is probably we should at least be thinking about that for efficiency's sake too.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think we've come to the end of our questions. We are getting close to the end of our sort of maximum of 15 minutes overtime. So I'm going to give each of you a last word, and then we're going to let people go back to their day jobs. But, Brett, why don't we start with you? Last words, thoughts?
Sure. Yeah, and I guess I'll close my the book with the following up on the last point, just that, you know, I think that on kind of in a little bit in a philosophical way, you know, the work that we're doing here at Wooden Bow Factory, I believe it extends beyond to the walls of the building in that, you know, so we're talking about how do organizations that may have lots of volunteers, and as opposed to full-time professionals, kind of carry this torch forward, right? And so at Wooden Bow Factory, the 10 people who are on our staff, we not only work with the students here, but we carry that lens out into the community, into our lives, outside the shop. And I have seen organizations that are able to, I know organizations that have the majority of their work done by volunteers, say 400 some odd volunteers working with 1,500 students. And they struggled a little bit with how to bring those people into the fold of what strengths-based is or what it means to be doing work in SEL. But it's totally possible, and I think that that as we continue to have these conversations about what it means to be a positive mentor and what those skill sets are, that this is going to grow organically, and these terms are going to become part of the common vernacular. And I think this is a really important, and I'm proud to be a part of this important moment and movement.
Great. Charles, last words, short ones?
I'll just say that, you know, reasoning about what we're trying to do with individual kids and what we think the result is, what we think the skills are, is super important. And that kind of conversation is important both to pick performance measures if you need measurement and you need to demonstrate something, but also after it's a criteria for selecting them. The information from the measures should help you have that conversation. And so the measures produced in the SEL challenge are in no way perfect according to a number of criteria, but we think they're really useful for that. And so we you know, thinking more about what are we trying to do with the kids and what do we think will happen with the result, what's the developmental change, that's just a super important conversation to keep having.
Great. And Evelyn, you're still
sure
here?
And this I'm still here. This also piggybacks off my notes said earlier, but I think oftentimes this SEL field can feel primarily education system focused or school focused. So I hope my call to action really is for leaders and policy makers to look at the wealth of knowledge that the out-of-school time offers, to learn from the best practices and programs out there about social and emotional learning. And I hope that we continue to really elevate that space.
Well, that's perfect. And I think that's where I will leave it. Spending a lot of time in rooms with people who have primarily an education focus, I think it's time we have what we need now to double down to make sure that they understand that this resource is there, both in terms of the youth programs, but also the potential that we have to really help them improve and have an impact on young people's lives. So with that, I want to thank all of you for even staying for an extended time. And we will talk to you all who are left on the phone next month, and we'll send out announcements later. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.